loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, firebrand nationalist Iraqi cleric Muqtada as-Sadr's party took a surprise lead in Iraqi elections today, making him the kingmaker in the decision to choose a new prime minister. Sadr has led two uprisings against the United States in Iraq and is seen as the enemy of both the United States and Iran. Next, former CIA officer, peace activist, and frequent guest on this show, Ray McGovern, was arrested last week for allegedly disrupting the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearing on Gina Haspel's nomination to be CIA director. Haspel has a past history as a high-level CIA officer who was integral to the agency's torture program. Prosecutors have now charged Ray with felony resisting arrest. Then, today, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then, nearly 60 protesters who were arrested on Inauguration Day last year are still awaiting trial on federal charges related to wearing masks in public. From an initial group of more than 200 people who faced felony rioting and destruction of property charges, 59 defendants are left. Six were acquitted on all counts in December, and all charges were dropped against more than 100 others. The trial has been delayed because federal prosecutors are having trouble finding expert witnesses to testify against the defendants. And finally, Catalonia has a new premier after 5 months of political deadlock. Quim Torra was handpicked by ousted leader Carles Puigdemont. Torra urged unity among Catalonians and promised to find common ground across the political spectrum. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Iraq. Firebrand nationalist Iraqi cleric Muqtada as-Sadr's party took a surprise lead in Iraqi elections today, making him the kingmaker in the decision to choose a new prime minister. Sadr has led two uprisings against the U.S. in Iraq and is that rare person who is seen as an enemy of both the United States and Iran. We're joined from London by Mujtaba Masood. He's an Iraqi journalist and a filmmaker whose films include Islamophobia, Cause and Effect, and ISIS, Islamic Extremism. Mujtaba, welcome back to the show. Mujtaba, everybody has been watching Muqtada as-Sadr over the past few weeks. They've been watching how his party has been gaining strength and gaining popularity. I'm not sure very many people at all expected him to be in a position that he finds himself in today. What happens now with Sadr and his party in such a strong political position?
Yeah, including myself and many other analysts on Muqtada as-Sadr, and he's able to basically gain the front in the election. We look at 54 seats currently, which are held by Muqtada al-Sadr's party, and followed secondly by Fatah Party, and then thirdly by the Abadi's current minister, which is known as the Nasser Coalition. Now, Sadr has been quite popular in recent times since the 2003 conflict, since the 2003 Iraq War, his resistance to the U.S., and most recently, his alliance with the Communist Party. Now, all these factors weren't really seen as like a major position. He wasn't in a major position to win the election. However, the alliance with civil groups and the Communist Party, as well as the idea of Iraqi nationality and no interference from the U.S. or from Iran, has really won over the voters. I mean, the 44% of Iraq that voted, of the population, seem to liken his viewpoints and his manifesto. That's not the full story. The full story comes when you need to form an actual government. Muqtada al-Sadr will have to form a government with most likely Haider al-Abadi's party. They're the only ones that are potentially in line. And he has said before that the Nasser coalition or Abadi is someone that he's willing to align himself with. So we're still in the early days. There's only 10 provinces that have declared their results. There's still another 8 provinces. But it looks like Sadr will be taking the lead. And it's a massive surprise to most analysts, even including myself, who I downplayed the role of or the potential for Muqtada as-Sadr to win. But he's surprised everyone and he's a front runner now.
This doesn't mean that Muqtada as-Sadr is going to be the prime minister of Iraq, but it does mean that he's going to have considerable authority in the decision of who becomes prime minister of Iraq, correct?
Yes. Because if it continues like this and we'll get the results in a few hours and he's still the front runner, then he will have a say in who the prime minister will be. He'll have the strongest word on that. However, he is not himself an elected member of parliament. He hasn't put his name forward as to become a politician. He's just someone who's basically almost like the supreme kind of person within that party. And having said that, you know, the 329 seats in the Iraqi parliament, you know, you need to gather more than half to form some sort of government. It's still going to be a struggle. We've got three parties here, which, you know, there's not much difference at the moment between the three. And even though they have gathered the most seats at the moment, the other party, the alternative party, is the paramilitary party, the Fatah party, who are much more closer to Iran, who are much more aligned with, you know, the state of law leader, who's Maliki, who only gained 25 seats. So it doesn't mean Iraq have completely sided with this idea of Sadr and his ideological viewpoint. There are many Iraqis that still view the successes of the PMUs, referred to as the Hashid in Iraq, as being majorly important as well, and they do have a lot of favorable support. It's just that those two parties may not see eye to eye in terms of forming an alliance, because, you know, Sadr is so anti-Iran in a way, and the PMUs are much closer tied to Iran.
Let's talk about the attitude towards this election and towards the surprising outcome by both the Saudi family, royal family, and also the Americans, of course.
Well, this is a major. I mean, if you look at the analysts and observers on Iraq, there seems to be a misunderstanding of Sadr's position and how he's developed over 15 years and so on. Sadr, this isn't the same Sadr in 2003. This isn't the same Sadr that rose up against the U.S. You know, Hadi was in charge of the leader of the Mahdi army, who was involved in a sectarian, you know, sectarian bloodbath between Sunnis and Shias. This is a new Sadr. A Shiite leader, Islamic leader, who's suddenly aligned himself with the Communist Party, has, you know, talked anti, given some anti-US and anti-Iran rhetoric, is deeply into this Iraqi nationalist civil society movements that are slowly emerging now in Iraq. And it goes way past the Da'wah and the Islamic Shia parties that have been ruling Iraq for the past 10 or 15 years. He's really opened up a new pathway. I'd say it's a post-sectarian Iraq we're looking at right now, and he's developed himself as someone who's able to kind of gather support from all sides of Iraq. Again, I mean, there are major issues in him trying to form a government, but the U.S. I think will look at this in a reluctant way. There's a lot of mockery going around saying that, you know, suddenly after the invasion of Iraq, you have someone who's potentially going to become leader, and he's the one who fought against the U.S. twice in terms of resistance after 2003. At the same time, Iran's advisor to the Supreme Leader, Ali Velayati, only a few months ago in February, released a statement saying that we will not allow liberals and communists to govern Iraq. And that's a very important statement. If Iran is against this possible coalition that Sadr is likely to form with Abadi, and the current zero-sum game between the U.S. and Iran really makes this a very difficult few months or few, you know, we have the government has 90 days to form, basically, after the results. And so these next 90 days are going to be tremendously important, and it will bring Iraq back into the limelight in terms of global news.
I want to just ask about the Communist Party. The 1958 revolution was led by, it was quite a united front, but the Communist Party was a strong party then, perhaps the strongest of all, and they were aligned with Qasim. Again, that government came to an end in 1963, and then there were successive Ba'athist governments. The Communist Party, while once a historic and significant party, seemed to be really just a shell. And then at the time of the U.S. invasion in 2003, because the Communist Party had been so persecuted by the Ba'athists and by Saddam, actually supported the U.S. invasion. What's the status of that party now?
If you look at the last election, the communists really didn't do well. Most of the parties that were dominant at the time were Islamic Shia parties. Right now, what we see is a major issue within the Sunni community in terms of leadership, which is why they really haven't gathered hardly any seats apart from Anbar. And you know, the Sunni population has kind of lost touch with their own leaders. And also, if we look at the Kurds at the moment, they're deeply divided. They're claiming that to be a re-election. They're claiming there's been fraud and so on. So they're unhappy in terms of what's happening. This is why I think the Communist Party has risen from these deeply divided parties. further to that, the 44% of Iraq that voted, I mean, any low percentage like that means that the most zealous of Iraqis will come out and vote. And I think the moderate took a hit here. And the Communist Party's alliance with Sadr is what really has risen their game. It wasn't about the Communist Party suddenly emerging in Iraq and people starting to find the viewpoints of communist appealing. It was literally the alliance with Sadr and the civil groups that played a massive part. And, you know, I think the issue of communism is something that will take a while to see the issues there. Because if you look at the Marja'iyya and the Najaf leadership, the Shia scholars, they will not allow any sort of communist leadership to take hold in Iraq. I think this is mainly about Sadr's main cult-like support, which has really caused a stir-up and really a shocking result.
You know, I want to say something, too, that I think many of our listeners probably don't know, and this is common all over the Gulf, is that just because an Iraqi happens to be a Shia Muslim does not mean that he's in any way supportive of Iran, necessarily. Most Iraqi Shia Muslims are Arab, and, of course, Iranians are Persians, and they even speak different languages at home. Of course, the Iranians speak Farsi and the Iraqis speak Arabic, but we shouldn't trick ourselves into thinking that just because someone is a Shia Muslim in Iraq, they're going to fall in line and support the Iranians.
Without a doubt. I mean, this current election, and we'll find out the results in the next few days, this will really give us an idea of a true pluralist Iraqi identity that is away from the U.S., that is anti-U.S. and anti-Iranian interference. And within the next few days, we'll see that.
Great. Well, we were joined from London by Mojtaba Masood. He is an Iraqi journalist and a filmmaker. His films include Islamophobia, Cause and Effect, and ISIS, Islamic Extremism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former CIA officer, peace activist, and frequent guest on this show, Ray McGovern, was arrested last week for allegedly disrupting the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearing on Gina Haspel's nomination to be CIA director. Haspel has a past history well known as a high-level CIA officer who was integral to the agency's torture program. Prosecutors have now charged Ray with felony resisting arrest. Ray McGovern joins us here in the studio. He was a CIA analyst under 7 presidents. He was also the personal morning briefer for President George H.W. Bush. And you can check out his work at www.raymcgovern.com. Ray, it's always great to have you. I hate to have you, though, here under these circumstances. You did something that none of the rest of us, really, besides those angels at Code Pink, had the guts to do in the Gina Haspel hearing. Can you walk us through it and tell us how it all played out?
Sure, John. Thanks for having me. I have to say that beforehand, I want to pay tribute to my Palestinian friends. I am sick. I'm physically sick at the killing of 52 of them today and the wounding of 2,400, adding up to about 10,000 wounded, about 90 killed. Since the Great March of Return, if you look at this, and you have to look at Al Jazeera or someplace, you see the Great Salt March of Gandhi repeated over and over again. It's peaceful, and they're mowed down. I just say one more thing. I'm eight years old when Israel is created, okay? I live in the Bronx in New York. 30% of people in my neighborhood were Jewish. We rejoiced. We went out, we celebrated, we ate everything we could, we rejoiced. But no one ever told me. No one ever told me there were people there already, right? I mean, like, it wasn't like desert. There were 700,000 Palestinians knocked out of their homes. Many of them, I know, I was there last February, March, still have the keys to their homes. So this was the great march for return. Just remember, people who think people have a conscience, that they were driven out 70 years ago. I was 8 plus 70. I mean, it's 8. I'm very upset about it, and perhaps you can tell. And all I want to do is say that it is a shameful thing to live in a country that enables all this. And our country is America, of course, and it enables what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. in a racist sort of way. The cardinal sin, the original sin of America, racism. Now you want to talk about Gina Haspel. Well, let me do a little bridge there. You can't torture people who look like you. Or you can, but it's much more difficult. You look at the people that we've tortured, they don't look like us. We call them towel heads. We call them camel jockeys. Our soldiers are indoctrinated to do that. Once you marginalize, once you dehumanize people, you can do anything you want to them. So that's part of it, and that's part of actually what I experienced for my 27 hours in the D.C. jail with my African-American brothers and sisters. So what I'm saying here on the Haspel thing is that it just strains credulity that she would be nominated to be head of the CIA, a place which used to tell the truth, a place where, and to see some of my former colleagues, I mean, people I worked with, people who did really good, Charlie Allen, for example, an incredibly bright guy, hard worker, and after 9/11, everything changed, including these people. All of a sudden, they lost all sense of a moral code, and there they are, whooping up with this Gina Haspel. Now, I have to explain that when I went in there, I had no intention to do anything specific. The Code Pink people were thrown out right away, but I stayed. And I was quite entranced with how Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina, how he started out his speech. He said, "Now this open hearing." And that means we'll go to closed session for secret stuff. But if you want, you know, I suppose there'll be some people who want to make a statement. If you want to make a statement, make it quick, and then be gone. I said to myself, wow.
Enlightened.
Yeah, I've never been, you know, make it quick and then be gone. I said, maybe I'll take advantage of that later. Well, after an hour and a half, Gina Haspel dodging and weaving, and Senator Biden says, Ms. Haspel, Were you in charge there at that secret base, that black base where al-Nashiri was tortured, yes or no? Senator, that's classified information, and we have to go to secrets. Now, Wyden ran out of time, right? But this next question would have been, well, Ms. Haspel, who was it that classified that? And she would have had to say, well, I did, actually. So here you had this spectacle of the nominee classifying, putting out of the public hearing so that Americans don't get to know that she was in charge. Indeed, everyone knows she was in charge. Every one of those senators knew because they have the documents. She was in charge of that black site in Thailand when al-Nashiri was waterboarded and other things. So here's McGovern. Finally, the cop between McGovern and Haspel goes to the bathroom or something, you know, she disappears. So I go up and I say as politely as I can. I think that Senator Wyden is entitled to a straight answer to that question. The answer, of course, is yes, she was in charge. And the prospect of her classifying it, and then all of a sudden I was set upon by four uniformed policemen, and I lost control of my freedom there, and you saw the rest of it on the video.
Well, let's just talk about what's on the video.
Yeah, the video went viral. It was viewed well over a million times between Facebook and Twitter, and I stopped counting on Saturday. And I'm looking at you, Ray. Your glasses are broken. You're pretty well beaten up, bruised. You're obviously in pain. Did they make any effort, any attempt at all to say, sir, you can't do that. Come out in the hall with us.
What we could see on the video was you were thrown down.
These hard.
Cops were on top of you.
Yeah. They just brutalized you right off the bat like that.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. You know, this is a lesson. I hope everybody listens. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. I did it because I thought it's the right thing to do. But there's always an angel somewhere hanging around. And there was some woman with a camera, with a iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And she was filming. And she was also saying, you're hurting him.
Yes.
You're hurting him, okay? Now, there was one person in charge here. He looked like a captain by the gold stripe in his hat. And he looked at the woman, and he looked at what was happening to me. And I could see him thinking real quick, now, do I seize the woman too, or do I grab the iPhone out of her hand with other people photoing by that time? And making photos, and he said, "No, he'd say, stop it. Okay, he doesn't stop trying to bend his shoulder around behind his back. This might dislocate his shoulder from an old basketball injury. And then, you know, they didn't treat me too badly after that. But it was, what I was trying to say is, had there been no caring woman who did two things, first off, film it, and second off, say, you're hurting him, you're hurting him. And, you know, that got on the tape. I don't know what would have happened to me, frankly, because either those Capitol Police didn't get the word that the chair had said, well, you can make a comment, make it brief, and then be gone,
right.
Or this was all a charade by the head of the committee, Richard Burr from North Carolina, who incidentally, as soon as he took the chair in early 2015, recalled all copies of the Senate investigation based on original CIA documents showing the heinous nature, not only of waterboarding, but the other treatment accorded to our prisoners. So first thing he did was try to recall all his copies. I believe probably Gina Haspel was the first one at his doorstep. Here's ours. And I don't know if there are any extant. There's said to be one in the Obama library, but if they went and told Obama to have it destroyed, past precedent would suggest that he would salute and have it destroyed.
Once you were arrested, well, most of us expected you to be charged with a misdemeanor very quickly, you pay $50 and then you leave. But the hours continued and you ended up staying in the DC jail for something like 27 hours. What took so long? What were they talking about in there?
Well, as I understand it, the cops themselves don't know exactly what's going on until they get the word from higher authority. What higher authority told them, look, don't let this guy out. Keep him overnight. We can say resisting arrest. And that was the other thing. Did you see the cops? They're saying, don't resist.
Stop
arrest.
Resisting. Stop right. resisting.
They always do that when they're beating the heck out of you.
That was it. Yep.
So, that's the rubric. You say stop resisting, and then people say, well, he must be resisting. But if you could see, I wasn't really under my own power or any of that once they seized me in front of the front where I was speaking. So they said, I think, well, he resisted arrest. That's really important. So we put him in a – now it was pretty – that those jail cells, they were, well, I kept thinking of what Dostoevsky said about how you measure the degree of civilization in a society. And of course, what he said was, you go visit the prisons. And it was there that I experienced. I recommend, John, I don't have to recommend it to you or you, Brian, but I recommend to all Americans that they spend at least 24 hours in a facility such as I had to spend my time in.
I have to echo that because I think that really very few Americans have any idea what goes on inside our jails and prisons in this country. You know, I remember the initial shock to me when I got to prison was that it was like walking into 1950s America.
Mm-hmm.
It's racist, it's segregated, it's violent, and nobody has to answer. I mean, nobody in any position of authority has to answer for any of their actions.
That's right. You're under total control. And you look at the, you know, it was a 6 foot by maybe 10 feet cell. There were two stainless steel slabs that when I was arrested early enough, so I had to spend a lot of time there from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until they brought us to a different place at 8 or 9 in the morning. But, you know, I said, well, do you have a mattress? And she looked at me and she said, everybody's treated the same here.
Yeah.
And I said,
you're not
going to
get special treatment.
I mean, doesn't everybody,
imagine.
Doesn't
that's
everybody
that's
get
true.
A mattress?
Because you're 78 years old and you've been brutalized. Don't think you're going to get a mattress.
I hate to say this. It kills me that we're out of time. But we want to have you come back and talk more about this. This is a very important issue. This is Ray McGovern joining us here in the studio. Ray was a CIA analyst under 7 presidents. He was also the morning briefer for President George H.W. Bush. And you can check out his very important work at www.raymcgovern.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Today, we continue our weekly segment. It's every Monday, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, Bill Ayers helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening to our schools, colleges, universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. Bill joins us once again from Chicago. He is an activist, an award-winning educator, and the author of numerous books, including Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill Ayers, welcome back.
Nice to hear your voice.
I'm looking at the front page of the New York Times from this morning. U.S. undercuts fraud inquiries into for-profits. Education Department forces a shift in college unit. What's this about?
Well, I think if you want to have an object lesson of capitalism messing up education, look at the New York Times this morning. That's the first headline that caught my eye as well. And what's up is that Betsy DeVos, as the new head of the Department of Education and the Trump administration, wants to undo even the most mild reforms that the Obama administration brought in. You know, part of Trump's goal in life is to erase Obama from the history books and from any policy impact. But this is particularly egregious, and it reminds us of why capitalism and education, real education, don't go together. So what's happening is that for-profit colleges, including, of course, Trump University, but DeVry and several others, were gouging students and giving them nothing for huge amounts of money that they took in. And the Obama administration opened an inquiry into the mismanagement and the fraud and the corruption in this process. And they had at one point, I think they had something like a dozen lawyers working on following up on students who'd been gouged and students who'd been taken advantage of in these four with the promise of a good education and getting actually nothing for the money they invested. And so Betsy DeVos comes in and she appoints the former dean of DeVry University, one of the universities under investigation. She appoints him to head the unit. So guess what? That went dark within a minute. And now they have, I think, three staff members, not a dozen lawyers, but three staff members, and the corruption continues. It's really a sad, sad story.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We talk every Monday, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, a weekly segment here on Loud and Clear. Bill, we're talking about, well, it's just a ripoff. The for-profit universities, or not all of them, but certainly many of them. And we now have the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos sort of acclimating or supporting or shielding these organizations. But it wasn't too long ago, just February of this year, I'm looking at the ABC News, federal court approves $25 million Trump University settlement. I'll read you a couple sentences. A federal court approved a $25 million settlement on Tuesday with students who said they were duped by Donald Trump and his now defunct Trump University, which promised to teach them, quote, secrets of success, close quote, in the real estate industry. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco finalized the settlement after it was first approved by a judge last March following an appeal by Sherry Simpson, a Florida woman who said she spent roughly $19,000 on Trump University workshops. Simpson had wanted to opt out of a class action lawsuit in order to pursue a separate suit against Trump, but the court rejected that. Yeah, so Donald Trump's right at the heart of this thing and has his own sort of predatory pursuits here.
Well, you're absolutely right. But also Betsy DeVos has spent a lifetime in profit making around education. And this to me is, I mean, you said maybe not all of these universities, but actually all of them are predatory and are ripoffs. There's absolutely no way that profit making, sorting people into winners and losers, and education as an ideal go together. They just don't go together. So what we have to do is understand the ways in which capitalism itself undermines education. And then the kind of egregious examples like these poor for-profit universities are only one kind of prong of the problem. There was a story in the Times last week about loopholes allowing colleges to mask loan defaults. That's not for-profit colleges. That's state universities, Ivy League universities. And instead of dealing with the ways in which they disserve their students and their alums, they hire consultants who mask the fact that there are all these defaults going on in education. So, I mean, this is not news, but I think it's hugely important to analyze and understand. You go to college today, you rack up a huge amount of debt for you know, a really sketchy kind of reasons, and then you end up kind of defaulting, and you spend the rest of your life trying to pay back these loans or go bankrupt and get it settled that way. But it's really a disservice, and it runs in the face of what we take to be education, which is always about enlightenment. It's always about empowerment. It's always about becoming stronger and more liberated. And this idea that education is a profit-making enterprise really undermines all of that.
Excellent point. I'm looking at another article from Business Insider. For-profit colleges have been ripping off veterans since World War II because, of course, veterans have benefits, education benefits via the GI Bill. And earlier, about 2 years ago, several veterans organizations petitioned the Department of Veterans Affairs to halt the flow of federal funding to for-profit colleges, including DeVry University, Corinthian Colleges, ITT Tech, and the University of Phoenix. I mean, this is those schools. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned about the other schools that are not considered these schools. And I just saw a shocking statistic, Bill. The amount of student debt, aggregated student debt, that American students have to go to college is now $1.5 trillion. And most people may not know that this is a debt you can never escape. There's no such thing as bankruptcy. You could be going to your grave with student debt that you're still paying. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right. They passed the in protecting the predatory lenders, Congress passed legislation that doesn't allow you to default on a student loan. It hangs around your neck forever. And this is really preying on students, preying on veterans is just so unthinkable in a free and open and fair society. But I think it's also worth noting that $1.5 trillion, a very important demand that those of us should be making as we build a unified progressive movement that's intersectional, that takes on many, many issues. One of the demands should be cancel the student debt. There's absolutely no reason for it. All we're doing is ripping off taxpayers to pay off big bankers. It doesn't benefit anybody. We should cancel the debt and move on from there. And that's something that I think we should be, students are building kind of momentum around this, but I think that we need to see this as part of a broad progressive agenda moving forward. The kind of thing we could ask candidates, that we could mobilize around, that we could build kind of support for. Cancel the debt.
Yeah, Bill Ayers is our guest. Again, our segment every Monday, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, award-winning educator, journalist, activist, and author. In your most recent book, or one of your more recent books, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto, you talk about how things may appear to be impossible, but they're not impossible. When it comes to a moratorium on student debt, not a moratorium, a cancellation of student debt, there's nothing impossible about that. That's a doable, realizable demand. And all around the world, at least in the industrial and in many parts of the developing world, there's no such thing as student debt. I mean, this can be done.
It can be done. And one of the themes of the book I wrote is that every issue I get into, whether it has to do with taxing or the military or healthcare, every one of these demands is actually quite reasonable. The reason the book is called Demand the Impossible is because if we stay within the lanes that are given to us, the options that are given to us, then we never release our radical imaginations. But all you have to do is begin to look at it, think about it, do a little research, and you realize that canceling the debt is well within our power, and it's something we ought to do. There's one other thing I'd like to point to from this morning's Times, if I could, and this is something we'll take on in the future. But if there's an editorial about Ben Carson and the Fair Housing Act, and, you know, one of the things we know is that these issues intersect. When you dive into education deeply enough, you're suddenly into housing, you're into healthcare, you're into taxation, you're into war, you're into militarization. But one of the things that very much impacts education is poverty. And one of the things that this administration is also doing is ratcheting up and failing to begin to address the question of poverty, the question of segregation. And therefore, we see in a city like Chicago or Washington or Baltimore, the concentration effects of poverty, including this raising of rents for people in public housing, refusing to build public housing, refusing to allow public housing to move into areas where we could have racial integration or even income integration. That means the concentration effects of poverty impact these kids dramatically. They go to crummy schools, which are crummy by design, not by accident. And I think that's something we ought to also pursue as we go along.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined by Bill Ayers. Every Monday, you can hear Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers right here on Loud and Clear. You can reach Bill Ayers or read his writings at billayers.org. That's www.billayers.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're going to talk about the continuing prosecution of those who were arrested on January 20th, 2017. That would be the day Donald Trump was inaugurated as the President of the United States. More than 200 people were arrested facing heavy, heavy charges, felony charges included, charges that would have brought potentially decades in prison. We're joined in studio by Chip Gibbons. He is a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. He has contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book, The Henry Kissinger Files. Chip Gibbons, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. So today, it's May 14th, and jury selection is beginning in the first J20 trial since the one in November that resulted in all six people being acquitted. But before I get to today, I want to point out that there are trials scheduled in March and in April, and they've been continued to June. And the reason for this is that the prosecution wanted to call as an expert witness a anonymous FBI agent who had infiltrated the Occupy Wall Street movement and who, because she receives weekly counterterrorism briefings, is an expert on anarchist extremism, and that she was going to testify as to what the quote-unquote black bloc tactic was, as well as, in her opinion, based on watching videos of the protest, that the black bloc tactic was used. A judge refused to allow her to testify anonymously and severely limited the scope of her expert witness testimony. He would not allow her to determine whether or not the black bloc tactic was used. All she could do was be an educational witness about what the black bloc is. And as a result, the prosecution withdrew her and they asked for a continuance on the most fascinating grounds. They said that they lost the first trial because they didn't have an expert witness. And they basically said, you know, we can't ask in good conscience a DC jury to sit through this trial again without an expert witness, essentially conceding that if they don't have this quote unquote expert, they'll lose. They've since found a new expert who read several books. That is her qualification. She read the Antifa Handbook. She read a number of well-known leftist books. So I guess reading books, you know, we should both be experts too at this trial, I guess. But today is the May 14th group, and they don't have an expert in this trial because this is the first time the prosecution is trying people who they're actually alleging committed property destruction. And the other ones, they're saying it's just a conspiracy, but this is the first time they're actually making that claim.
It's very interesting, and I think it says so much about what this prosecution really was all about. I mean, we had tens of thousands of people who came on January 20th to protest the inauguration of Donald Trump. Because I'm a member of the Answer Coalition, we were down along the inaugural parade route. We had gotten a permit to be there. Other people were carrying out other actions all around the city, but the government had also set up checkpoints. So even the people who wanted to come, say, to the Answer Coalition demonstration couldn't get through those checkpoints. People were lined up 3, 4, 5 hours. And at certain points, at different places, people would have marches. They'd have their own kind of spontaneous protests. They weren't coming to the rally site. And then at a certain point, after a group of people were marching, and there was some amount of a very limited amount of windows being broken or other property damage, the cops moved in, the DC police moved in, and arrested everybody who was in proximity. It was called kettling. And then instead of just, which was bad enough, instead of doing just that, they charged all these people. They really wanted to send them to prison, but so far they're not succeeding. I mean, it's a remarkable statement about what's actually happening.
It is extremely remarkable. And I sat through parts of the first trial and the prosecution stressed again and again. They followed for 30 minutes and so many blocks. And it's like, well, if it's this bad of a riot, like you're saying, why are they following for 30 minutes? And the police clearly showed up that day with the intent to arrest people. There's ample evidence of that. There was an infiltrator in the group. The police did not show up planning on doing anything else but shutting down the protest because the police thought they were anarchists. Some of them were. It's not a crime to be an anarchist. Surprise. And I mean, I think what's also very telling is the fact that the prosecution still doesn't have its case together after a year and a half. In the March and April trials, they're asking for more time after a year and a half because they can't prove their case. There are four people going on trial today. There were supposed to be six. Two of them got continuances. The one continuance was because the judge ruled the prosecution did not have ample evidence of conspiracy to tie them to conspiracy. And, you know, instead of dismissing the charge, he gave them a continuance to find time to find more evidence. And he asked them to review the other 58 cases, if there's anybody else situated. And the prosecution responded by adding two more charges to the people who are on trial today, assaulting a police officer and resisting an arrest.
Yeah, and again, for the lay public, which is the public, you might not know, but when you're charged with assaulting a police officer, it sounds bad, like you've actually done something to the police. But I know from personal experience, this charge can be just a throwaway charge. I mean, it can be absolutely nothing.
It's a misdemeanor. I mean, they're facing felony charges, and assaulting a police officer is not one of them. It's a misdemeanor. Kirchhoff had tried to charge them earlier, assaulting a police officer. She used the wrong statute. She used a statute that had been repealed. She's made a lot of really fascinating choices throughout this trial, and it was thrown out. It's entirely unnecessary, and it's just a vindictive move against the defendants for challenging the conspiracy charge. And there's a group of defendants right now who are trying to have their charges thrown out on the grounds that this is a retaliatory prosecution. So they dropped all but 58 of the charges. They're saying these are the worst of the worst, the ones they have strong evidence against. But in a number of cases, there's no difference between this 58 and the other 200. But they include people who have been involved in the ACLU lawsuit against the police for police brutality. They include the most outspoken defendants challenging the prosecution. And surprise, surprise, in spite of the fact that they have extremely weak cases, they're still facing charges. So they're challenging that as a retaliatory prosecution, that for, you know, challenging these charges, they're having their lives continue to be disrupted. And there's a real history of vindictiveness throughout this case. They're initially charged with one count of felony rioting, which is not a charge in D.C. The defendants ask for clarification. They then come back with six felony charges. And then in this case, you see people who have sued the police get their charges continue on even further. When people question the grounds for conspiracy, they then have an assaulting a police officer charge. And I think this is just typifies the vindictive nature of the prosecutor, Jennifer Kirchhoff, and what's really motivating this sort of insidious prosecution.
Let's talk about Peter Neusham. He was then acting police chief, now been confirmed as police chief. Back in the day, in 2000, 2002, I was personally one of the people arrested in a mass arrest, just like this. I mean, kettling. And if you read the news accounts, it sounded like we were rioting the streets, even though we were just marching on a sidewalk. Again, for the public, it's important to be very skeptical because the police reports get echoed in the media, and then you're kind of convicted in the press. And for those people who wanted to go forward and have a trial, you know, or affirm their rights, there was a lot of vindictiveness back then. Then that practice was banned by the city council, by the D.C. council. Peter Neusham's back, the tactic's back.
That sounds like more than a coincidence to me, but I don't know. We'll find out eventually, I guess. But it's worth coming. The media coverage has been really bad. I mean, every time like the Washington Post mentions the trials, they always go into the limousine that was burned. This limousine was burned. They always include that picture. They always say, oh, these defendants were connected to burning the limousine. The limousine was set on fire hours after they were already arrested. So there's no relationship to this.
So important. Because nobody would know that unless you actually know it.
Yes. I mean, and the police chief has appeared on news stations like, oh, yeah, these are the people who, you know, burnt the limousine. And it's like, no, they weren't. I mean, unless the police, while kettling them, marched them over the limousine and let them torch it, which, you know, is an absurd.
Or there could be let's be real. I mean, there's undercover police infiltration. There's agent provocateurs.
Yes.
This happens. I mean, why couldn't the police just, or an undercover cop, be the one to, you know, lob a Molotov cocktail into a limo and let it burn, and then that's basically their evidence, even though it was hours after the arrest.
Yeah, I mean, that's not unheard of. I mean, there was an undercover officer, at least one, who testified during the first trial. Apparently, the fact that I and other journalists reported on his testimony and his name is the reason why they wanted the FBI agent to testify anonymously. We were all being mean to her by doing what journalists do, reporting on what he said during the trial using his name. This is actually cited in their motion to keep her identity anonymous, which is just absurd. So it's just been a series of absurdities, one after the other, and it's really upsetting because people have had their lives disrupted for a year and a half now, and they're facing 60 years in prison, and that's not an easy thing to face.
Incredible. And one of the remarkable things was that, and I think the police expected under these kind of heavy prosecutions, people would try to seek their own individual salvation. They'd cop to lower charges because they just couldn't afford it. But in our last minute, the defendants here have a remarkable degree of unity amongst them.
There's a defendant organized collective, Defend J20 Resistance, and they have points of unity, and they have really been working together to resist these charges. And I think at the end of the day, when the history of this is written, the real story will be the story of defendant solidarity, more so than Kirchhoff and police.
Because without pleading to lesser charges, the police have to actually, the cops, the DA actually have to prove their case in court. And so far, they just haven't been able to.
No, they have not.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Chip Gibbons. Chip is a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent. Chip, what's your website?
It's www.rightsanddissent.org.
Okay, go to that website. Chip is also a journalist. He's contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book, The Henry Kissinger Files. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Catalonia has a new premier after 5 months of political deadlock. Quim Torra was handpicked by ousted leader Carles Puigdemont. Torra urged unity among Catalonians and promised to find common ground across the political spectrum. We're joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Dick, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Dick, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times today saying that the reason this took so long to find a leader for Catalonia was that they had to specifically find someone who could lead and who didn't have criminal charges pending against him. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's true. Criminal charges, of course, are those imposed by the Spanish state.
Right.
So they had got criminal charges up against Carles Puigdemont, who was the obvious first choice, and then criminal charges against other candidates, including Jordi Sanchez, who was the previous head of the Catalan National Congress and the number two on Puigdemont's ticket, and then criminal charges against other candidates. So basically what happened was the Spanish state was not going to accept the result of the December 21 election as a vote of confidence in the ticket of Carles Puigdemont and in more generally in the pro-independence forces in Catalonia, which won the election. So to prove their point that they were not going to endorse any of these people who they had brought criminal charges against or had the legal system bring criminal charges against, they said, we will appeal to the Constitutional Court anybody who has got criminal charges against them. And, of course, the Constitutional Court, which does their bidding, therefore made a whole series of provisional rulings which ruled these people out of possible candidacy as president. And so then they were left in a situation where there had to be, before 22nd of May, a candidate. Otherwise, this would have gone to a new election here. We would have gone to new elections. The independence camp as a whole thought that this was not a very good idea. So in the end, they arrived at Kim Torra. Kim Torra is there because he's a close follower of Puigdemont, but he's got no criminal charges hanging over his head.
But Kim Torra is pro-independence, and he, of course, is a protege of Carlos Puigdemont. How is this going to be any different from what we've seen over the last 10 or 12 months?
Well, it's not. It's a guarantee of more conflict. The basic problem is that the Spanish state never thought that they would lose the December, the Spanish government, I should say, never thought they would lose the December 21 election. They were counting on divisions within the pro-independence camp, because there's three parties. They were counting on their own control of the situation. They were counting on a massive support for the unionist parties, and yet that didn't eventuate. What they did was produced a counter-mobilisation of pro-independence forces and pro-independence people in Catalonia, which they had never anticipated. And the highest participation ever in a Catalan election as a result of that. So then they have to live with this result, and that's where we are today. So basically, the basic question, which is the right of self-determination of Catalonia versus the unity of the Spanish state, has not been resolved and can't be resolved. And tomorrow there will be conversations between Rajoy, the Spanish Prime Minister, and Pedro Sanchez, the leader of the Socialist Party opposition, as to whether or not they will actually carry out their promise at the time that they implemented the intervention from the Spanish state into Catalonia, into its finances, into its whole administration. Will they? They promised that as soon as there was an election, that intervention would end. Now they've got to make a decision of whether they should do that. And the most right-wing party in the Spanish state, the most centralist, this is Citizens, the sort of new right party, is demanding of Rajoy, as part of their competition for hegemony over the right wing in the Spanish state, that they not abide by that promise. So what is, once again, Catalonia has become the hot potato in Spanish politics.
Yeah, and where do we go? And partly, you know, there's all this maneuvering and all the, or certainly the central state, the Spanish state and its main parties are in a corner in a way. There is no absolute or actual resolution at hand. But then where does the independence movement go? Because clearly the sentiment for independence, or let's put it a different way, the sentiment for self-determination, the right to be self-determining, which doesn't mean, it's like the right to divorce. You have the right to divorce. It doesn't mean you're absolutely going to be divorced or you want to be divorced. But it's the right to divorce, which becomes the thing right now. And yet, at the same time, that sort of feeds into and goes down the same sort of intersects with those who actually do want not just self-determination, but self-determination to mean actual independence. So what about this movement, that side of the ledger? Where does it go?
You've put your finger on the, and I think the most interesting thing here, if this is a war of attrition, that's the best way to understand it. It's a war of attrition being fought without guns, being fought with legal through the legal system, but now increasingly being fought as a battle for public opinion in Europe. And ever since the German legal system freed Puigdemont provisionally and said, this man did not commit rebellion, we are not sending him back to we're not sending him back to Spain. That has shifted the battleground here and has put the Spanish state on the defensive, because what's effectively happening now is that the Spanish legal system is now on trial. And what is going to happen is that the new incoming Catalan government has said, and Torra said today, we will put up for legislation in the House, in the Catalan Parliament, all this progressive social legislation, social and environmental legislation against climate change, and a whole heap of things like a guaranteed minimum income, which is presently stalled in the Constitutional Court. And we will dare the Spanish government to reappeal this stuff to the Constitutional Court. And what they're doing is preparing the grounds for a election down the track, if the Spanish government continues to act as it's acted to date, which will be an election about a Catalan right to decide. And this time it will have a more clearer social component. That is to say, you can either vote for these unionist parties who have actually voted for this legislation in the parliament when it was first put up. It was very hard to vote against it. You know, equal rights for men and women, getting rid of the gender gap in wages and conditions, et cetera, et cetera. But then that was all blocked by the Constitutional Court. We're going to put all this stuff up again, and then we're preparing like a sort of grounds on which, if the Spanish state blocks this once more, we've got a broader package with which we can go to the population, which is then not just about independence, yes or no. It's about the right of Catalonia to decide and the kind of society we want. And hence, this is what they mean by unfolding the republic when they talk about that.
The whole process is so fascinating because it shows how a situation has its own life, its own dynamism, its own dialectic. We had the Spanish state really probably enjoying in Catalonia majority sentiment, it would seem to me, of people who, even if they wanted self-determination, still did not want independence, coupled with those who actually just really wanted to be part of Spain. And yet it's frittered away that support as a consequence of its repression, as a consequence of its heavy-handedness. And now you see the same thing, the same dynamic playing out within the theater of European public opinion, such that the Spanish state, which had all the cards, which had the weak, which had the strong hand, suddenly appears to be playing a weak hand. And momentum also matters, because once momentum is established by one side or the other, those people who feel, hey, we can actually achieve something, want to achieve something. And as Dick Nichols is saying, it's not simply about whether to be or not to be a part of Spain. It's about what kind of Catalonia do we want? What kind of Barcelona do we want? What kind of society do we want? And thus, now at center stage becomes all these social issues that have a profound appeal to all working people, regardless of how they might feel on the issue originally of self-determination. Anyway, 1 minute left, Dick.
Well, you've just said a lot of things there which are true. And the interesting dynamic is that Torra, who comes from a rather right-wing Catholic Carlist background and has got some very unfortunate tweets about and comments about, you know, Spaniards, what he calls Spaniards, when he's really talking about the Spanish establishment, he is having to adopt an increasingly progressive message. And today, in his second speech, he said, why are we having a republic? We're having a republic because we want a better life for people and we want a republic for Spain. Well, I'm glad that's very good that he's saying that, because that's a very powerful message to put across the border into Spain. You know, that is to say, the Catalan formation of a Catalan republic, which is a Catalan social republic, as the first stage in developing and driving forward a republican movement in the Spanish state. That's a very, very, that's a good message to put across there. Because it's saying that there's an alliance between the Catalan process and the process against the Spanish establishment, the super rich, the corrupt elites that have been running the Spanish state. So it's a message that Podemos, if they can straighten out their own game, can run with and run with against the PSOE.
Interesting. We're going to keep following it. But John, what Dick Nichols is saying is that even could be moving the Spanish Republic in total,
yes,
to the left.
Indeed. Well, we were joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He's the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Thank you.